life imprisonment. Amy Goodman's got something about the Virginia Commonwealth University. We're in a university town, so it's even more important, but it's about the Palestine exception, holding a degree back. Then Jewish for Peace had a demonstration that I didn't hear about anywhere else. Maybe Amy covered it on headlines. I've been reading Amy more than listening or watching because some of it is just so wrenching. Anyway, Flashpoints going to twice. I have an article upcoming in the Public Eye about the mini modular nuclear plant that the U of I wants to build along with Nano. I've run into a lot of people who are informed citizens and they've never heard of it. So the tsunami and earthquake out on the Russian East was pretty sobering. That was a big one. And if it happened in California, they have two very old nuclear plants that are embrittled by neutron flux. The reactor pressure vessels are that could crack. Maybe just a pipe, but maybe it could be the whole vessel, even though it's 8 inches of steel. Okay, sobering stuff, yeah. Amy Goodman had a part two with Vicki Ward, the journalist that broke the Epstein story, basically. Brought it into public, brought it into prosecution, etc. And it goes on for a half hour. I don't know how long the first segment was. But I'm not going to play the whole thing, but I wanted to bring your attention to it, so we'll hear a segment of it. And then Flashpoints is starting a new segment, regular segment, with Sam Husseini, who's ensconced in D.C. inside the Beltway, getting thrown out of the press club and manhandled every now and again. Admirable work on his part, I think. Called Frontline. I guess Frontline might be retired on PBS. The last episode was excruciating to watch. It had some highlights that were good, but 2 hours of it was, it was Wednesday this week or Tuesday or something. I don't know. I did endure it. Thought I should look through the transcript too. I think there was only one reporter, actually. It was all, you know, ex-government officials. This is all about the attack on Iran once by the nuclear site attack once by Israel and then once by U.S. Trying out a new bomb. He loves it. Wasserman talking about that, but he's also talking a bit at the beginning about repositioning nuclear subs because Trump and Medvedev are having a squabble on social media. Oh. It's interesting that some missiles were brought out of storage and repositioned before this latest move, so it actually wasn't a one-off. It could be seen as a part of a stage of waving the nuclear sword. There's a better expression for that, but I can't recall it right now. Anyway, that's the preamble. I didn't want to talk this long, as usual, but 4 minutes in, let's get an underwriting announcement in right now from the Park District. Great, very hot jazz show in the park. There's one more left. Welcome to August. New Hiroshima Nagasaki Day coming up in the middle of the week. I had a quip on that, but I'll spare you.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and the Champaign Park District. Enjoy live jazz music? Champaign Park District's Jazz in the Park concert series is happening all summer long at a variety of park locations. Everyone is invited to bring lawn chairs, snacks, and refreshments. The full Jazz in the Park schedule can be found at champaignparks.org.
The Education of Serene Haddad. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Never let your schooling get in the way of your education is a quote attributed to Mark Twain or a contemporary of his, the writer Grant Allen. The point has been displayed across college campuses over the past almost 2 years as students mounted protests in solidarity with Palestinians, met with often violent crackdowns by campus authorities, police, and vigilantes. One striking example of the suppression of dissent occurred at Virginia Commonwealth University, a public research university in Richmond, Virginia. On Monday, April 29, 2024, students gathered outside Cabell Library protesting U.S. support for Israel's attack on Gaza. Serene Haddad, a Palestinian-American student, was one of the organizers. Her father, Dr. Tarek Haddad, is a Virginia cardiologist who grew up in Gaza. 2 months earlier, he'd been invited to a roundtable meeting with then-Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He explained his refusal to attend, breaking down as he spoke on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
Some context is necessary here to understand why I turned this invitation down. So I have hundreds of family members in Gaza, both sides of my family, both in the town of Khan Yunis and the Gaza City. I've had about 100 family members at this point who have been killed, including physicians, pharmacists, lawyers, engineers, dozens and dozens of children, multiple small babies. I can't tell all their stories, but I just want to tell a few just for the audience. October 25th, 10 members of my family, all three generations of one side of my family, were all killed. My cousin Jamad al-Farra, his son, who is a physician, Dr. Tawfiq al-Farra, his wife, who was pregnant, two of their beautiful daughters, Reem and Hala, Jamad's brother, Assam, his wife, Samad, their daughters, Rusul, Tuqa, and Nadian, all multiple generations, all killed.
Dr. Haddad continued to recite the names of family members killed. Now, 18 months later, the number is over 200. Serene recalled the day of the VCU protests, speaking recently on Democracy Now!
Many people at Virginia Commonwealth University set up an encampment with the aim to pressure the university to divest from death and divest from Israel. And instead of being supportive and instead of hearing the students out and instead of understanding that students were there because they did not want their tuition dollars, our tuition dollars going to killing our people and my family, instead what they did is send three different police forces that night to come and brutalize us.
13 students were arrested. Serene, bloodied and bruised, was not charged. If they were guilty of anything, it would have been for taking the university at its word. Proudly emblazoned on VCU's website is the phrase, "unafraid to challenge the status quo," unquote. Indeed, VCU President Michael Rao, in his 2023 State of the University speech, said,
"At VCU, we have not been known to follow status quo because we don't. We're here to transform students' lives with the skills and the tools that they need to build the lives they want for themselves, but listen to our students and what they say, but also to help them with the many others that they're concerned about. I love this generation. They love other human beings."
It was a strange way to show love for the students with pepper spray, tear gas, and police. This April, Serene and about 40 other students gathered on the anniversary of the protest. One observer likened the peaceful assembly to a picnic. Once again, it was broken up by police. Serene was targeted as an organizer and, along with another student, was told that VCU would withhold their diplomas. She was a stellar student, completing her 4-year psychology degree in 3 years.
They were requiring me to take a class on morals and ethics. I do not need the validation from a university that is materially invested in the killing of children, the killing of thousands of people to get my degree. I don't need the validation from them to tell me that I need to take a class on morals and ethics, when in reality, I understand that I'm on the right side of history.
Serene appealed the withholding of her diploma, and this week, 82 days later, she won. She responded on Democracy Now!
This was not VCU choosing to do the right thing or them waking up and realizing that they made an error. This was the result of pressure on a case that they could not defend. It was the result of truth prevailing, and they were left with no choice because the truth was always on our side. I cannot separate this small victory from the reality that at this very same moment, millions of Palestinians are being starved in Gaza intentionally, systematically, and with the support of the very systems that tried to silence me. And the fact that I had to fight for my own diploma, something that I rightfully earned, is a testament to the exact same systems that are upholding and enabling genocide.
Serene Haddad has finally won her degree. More importantly, this talented young graduate in challenging starvation and genocide in Gaza has gotten an education. Instead of being forced to take a class in ethics and morals, she could teach one. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! We're standing outside the offices of New York Senators Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer. Jewish Voice for Peace has shut down this office building. A number of people are getting arrested. Inside, others are about to be arrested. Among them, New York State Assembly Member Claire Valdez of Queens and New York City Council Member Tiffany Caban. Also protesting are the actor Sara Ramirez of Sex and the City and other TV shows, as well as well over 100 people, Jews and their supporters. Their T-shirts say, "Stop arming Israel and stop starving Gaza."
I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, and we are here as Jewish New Yorkers shutting down the offices of Senator Schumer and Gillibrand, demanding that they stop starving Gaza. People are getting arrested right now because we are outraged, we are horrified witnessing these scenes of starvation, of Israel's incredible violence against the people of Gaza. And just 2 days ago, both Schumer and Gillibrand voted for more weapons to Israel. So we as Jewish New Yorkers are outraged. We say not in our name and not in our dime.
I'm here because I must be with my people. And my people are Jewish Voice for Peace, who have been fighting this genocide relentlessly for 3 years.
You got arrested at Grand Central.
Yeah, you interviewed me. We were on the floor. We shut down Grand Central Station almost 2 years ago. We shut down the Statue of Liberty. We shut down the Manhattan Bridge. We have raised our voices. We have fought the corporations and the Zionists, and I'm a Jew, but I am an anti-Zionist Jew, and it means that I do not believe that a Jewish state is a valid entity, because it's based on the exclusion and the extermination of a whole other people. They did that to us, and now we do that to another people? No.
With the Palestinian Youth Movement, and we're here to protest the unconscionable vote by Gillibrand and Schumer against blocking arms shipments to Israel. The time has gone far beyond words. It's time for actions. And now these senators are on the record supporting, you know, continued arms flow to a country that's committing a genocide. And we're here to say that that's unacceptable.
What do you think of these mainly Jews who are getting arrested?
I think it's a great sign of you know, that the movement against the genocide, that the support for the Palestinian right to life, is a cause that mobilizes all people. It mobilizes people across religion, across race, across class. And I think, you know, when I look at the crowd today, I just see that reflected back so clearly.
New York Senators Gillibrand and Schumer's offices, the last of the protesters are getting arrested, including New York City Council Member Tiffany Caban and Claire Valdez, New York State Assembly Member.
Stop starving Gaza! Let Gaza live! Stop starving Gaza! Let Gaza live! Stop starving Gaza! Let Gaza live!
Tiffany, why are you getting arrested?
We're here to
to stand in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza who are being starved to death right now. It needs to stop. We're using USA dollars to help them do it, and it has to end.
My, that was bracing. Reminds me, I haven't been to a raucous, maybe civil disobedience type demo. Actually, I don't remember the last demo I was that had civil disobedience involved. I documented the Indivisibles event in Lincoln Square, and that's main speakers are on my Facebook page. I haven't done anything with the other video. It was bad sound all around. And not the best kind of good trouble. It was on the event remembrance of John Lewis 5 years after his passing. There's some better good trouble to get into, it seems to me. Something today from 1 to 3. I hope my horse repair goes smoothly after I leave the studio here and that I can attend. I hope someone is documenting it. There have been some additions to the list. It's the Channing Murray Foundation from 1 to 3. A More Perfect Union, Building the World We All Deserve. Community leaders, number Reverend Evelyn Burnett used to be on the radio here doing an interview show. And first African-American on a school board in town. Professor Jay Rosenstein, Peabody Awarding Documentary, News Honor, and the one about prayer in schools, too. Spencer Wilkin, the Kingfisher Mascot Movement. James Kilgore wasn't in the early publicity. He's director of advocacy and outreach for First Followers, a reentry program trying to remedy the carceral state that we live in. Claudia Lenoff, working with the Healthcare Consumers, actually founding it, executive director in the hard fight. Amy Rickman is co-organizer of SOS Coalition, which you can Google for to get more info and backup. Again, 1 to 3 today. Summer of Solidarity, fifth and final panel. Cope Cumston has been replaying segments on the Wednesday show, Catch the Beat on Market Street. Time is slipping into the future. My gosh. Be editing on the fly here a little bit, mostly from the Vicki Ward follow-up off the air. Web exclusive from Amy Goodman, but I mentioned at the top that I've got an article about the mini nuclear, and it actually looks into nuclear, the Price-Anderson Act that limits liability for corporations and passes over to guess who? The taxpayer in case of an accident is coming up for a renewal, and I think that people ought to stand and fight, even if you support nuclear power in a deregulatory environment we have now. I think it would give you pause, and maybe you should oppose it, because it looks like a mad rush to me. Harvey Wasserman, longtime activist, mid-70s, started on his anti-nuclear campaign. He has stuff on Ohio electoral politics, too. He's involved in fighting gerrymandering unsuccessfully, but maybe here and there he had a success. Anyway, that's too big of a preamble, but yeah, here comes the tsunami. We have a big fault in the in the Midwest that when it goes, it's big, turns the rivers around, cracks the granite in Giant City in southern Illinois, and does all sorts of amazing things. Could crack some nuclear pressure vessels, maybe, or the pipes leading to them. Old reactors, it's a bad combination, and there's somebody doing research about deglaciation of the Sierra Nevadas affecting the fault structure. It's quite well known in the Himalayas that the deglaciation is there, is affecting the fault structures. I think it's quite well known. Not well known enough in this big 8.8 thing on in the Russian east could easily be related to deglaciation in the Himalayas. Here's Harvey Wasserman.
You may have heard that the president of the United States, so-called, says that he has moved nuclear submarines in strategic locations focused at Russia, given the statements, he says, by a former Russian president. We're going to talk about that and the dangers that that presents with our good friend Harvey Wasserman, who is a master and expert on nukes and no nukes, fighting the dangers of nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And hopefully we'll also be joined by Linda Seely. She's with Mothers for Peace. And then we're going to talk also about Diablo Canyon and what might have happened if or might happen if we're hit, if the coast is hit, if Diablo Canyon is hit by a similar tsunami as the one and the storm that hit Russia. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Harvey Wasserman. Tell us about your thoughts in terms of the repositioning of these nuclear subs.
Dennis, it's always great to be with you. And what we're dealing with here is two satanic madmen, Putin and Trump. And neither of them are really predictable in any sane or rational manner. The idea that they're saber-rattling now and that Trump would move nuclear-armed submarines within range of Russia, and that Putin is rattling his atomic bomb capabilities is unsettling, to say the least. And I got to remind everybody that there are a number of nuclear power plants in the war zone between Ukraine and Russia, six at Zaporizhzhia, another two at Kursk, that he could hit. Doesn't need a nuclear weapon. Trump doesn't need a submarine. All he needs is a drone. Could hit any of these reactors and cause another Chernobyl-scale disaster. So, Dennis, this is really terrifying. We have two guys with nuclear capability who are not rational, not sane. I have zero empathy or compassion, and we can't predict what's going to happen. This is the curse of the peace, so-called peaceful atom.
Russia just got hit by a massive storm. You've suggested that if that kind of storm hits directly on Diablo Canyon, we might have to kiss a good part of the coast goodbye.
All of it. I mean, there was an 8.9 earthquake, 8.8, 8.9, which is about as powerful as they get. There was a 9.0 not long ago, which is about the top of the scale. But thankfully, this one hit where there were no nuclear power plants. And for no real logical reason, it did not hit in Central California. And we know at Diablo Canyon, which is 9 miles west of San Luis Obispo at Avila Beach on the Pacific Ocean, there are at least a dozen major earthquake faults. And it's 45 miles from the San Andreas, which is more than capable of delivering an 8.9 or 9.0 seismic shock. And we are 100% certain that the two reactors at Diablo Canyon, which are more than 40 years old and have never been really, they were not constructed to withstand anything close to that kind of an earthquake. And God forbid, if an earthquake the size that we just saw in Russia, so we know it's entirely possible, had hit anywhere near Diablo Canyon, all of California now would be a radioactive wasteland, because those two reactors could easily be reduced by rubble and send a radioactive cloud of apocalyptic size into the air in California. Mostly it would go generally from north to south, so it would come right into Los Angeles with a mere 11 million people. But at some point it would blow back up into the Bay Area and around through the Central Valley, which is responsible for so much of the food that feeds our country.
Say a little bit more, Harv, if you could, say a little bit more about how the condition of Diablo Canyon. We're hearing the nuclear experts, in quotes, saying that they are still safe, and actually they want to expand the nuclear footprint, that nukes are the way to go.
Well, these guys are every bit as sane as Trump and Putin. Trump has just decimated the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the regulatory agency that oversees the 94 commercial reactors currently operating or licensed in the United States. We basically, those guys, Elon Musk's techno kids, have essentially stripped the staff from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So there is no effective federal regulation of the nuclear power plants in this country, and that includes Diablo Canyon. Gavin Newsom's making a big show of fighting Donald Trump, but he has signed on to Donald Trump's energy policy, which is to promote nuclear and kill solar. Nobody's been more effective at killing solar in this country than Gavin Newsom. And at the same time, when the legislature was strong-armed in 22 to keep Diablo Canyon open, there was a moment where U.S. Senator Padilla cross-examined a guy named Christopher Hansen, who was the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And Donald Trump and Hansen assured Padilla that Diablo would be heavily regulated and would be safe. And Donald Trump has just fired Christopher Hansen. It's the first time in the 50-year history that a president of the United States has fired a commissioner from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then, Dennis, within the last couple of days, a Republican woman on the committee, Annie Caputo is her name, has resigned. So instead of five commissioners, there are now three, and the staff at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been decimated. So not only is Diablo Canyon not insured, there's no insurance at Diablo Canyon. You got to have insurance to drive your car, but PG&E doesn't have to have insurance to drive a Diablo Canyon. Not only is there no insurance, but there's really no regulation now. You know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was always a nightmare. We called it no real chance or nobody really cares. But in reality, they did have some staff that were reasonably competent, and they could get us information from time to time. That's all gone. You know, like PBS, there is no more Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the state government, under federal law, has no ability to inspect any safety issues at any commercial atomic reactor, which includes Diablo Canyon. The studies are very clear, Dennis. Those reactors, which are 40-plus years old, cannot withstand anything remotely the size of the earthquake that just hit in Russia. So God forbid,
amazing.
There should be such an earthquake now in California. We will have an apocalyptic radioactive cloud that will make most, if not all, of the state permanently uninhabitable.
And yet, it is the case, after all the resistance and all the information, some of which you're sharing now, it seems like what we're hearing is the future of energy is in nuclear. How does that compare to solar? Your group, Solartopia, you've been Solartopia for a long time. How can you compare and contrast?
Well, what's happening in the real world, Dennis, is 95% of the new electrical generating capacity in the world today the new stuff, what's coming online, is all wind and solar. For one basic reason, the market. Wind and solar have absolutely plummeted in cost along with battery technology and geothermal. And so there's a total revolution going on. You know, they're talking about these small reactors. It's a sham. It's a smokescreen. They're not going to happen because they are literally 10 times as expensive as wind and solar. So these guys are jumping up and down, primarily in the United States. I mean, there's some movement around in other places. But the world is now undergoing a revolution in renewable technology, which Gavin Newsom, in this state, unforgivably, is attacking. He's just like Trump. He is against renewable energy. He talks a good game. He's got this bill that you won't be able to buy a gas-fired car in California in 2035. Nobody in 2035 anywhere on this earth is going to be buying a gas-fired car, whether they're legal or not. Electric cars are, 20% the cost to operate as a gas-fired car. The Chinese have built an electric car called BYD, which they're build your dreams, which they're selling all over the world. They are selling an electric car that can charge in 5 minutes for a 300-mile range. And such a car in the United States would be $50,000. In China, it's $15,000. It's ridiculous. So we have lost our auto industry, and the Chinese now are selling about 10 to 1 or more in solar panels what we are selling worldwide. And the same with batteries. We have just basically, we are now a backwater, and Gavin Newsom has been a part of that because we had a deal in 2018. Jerry Brown was the governor. Gavin was the lieutenant governor to phase out the two reactors at Diablo and phase in renewables. And the only thing that's changed is that the renewables have gotten way, way, way more cheaper, more cheap, and way, way, way less, more efficient. And California right now should be 100% solar. We have the technology. And in fact, at certain times of day, 100% of our electricity does come from solar. But Newsom, and he's personally responsible, has stepped in to allow Diablo Canyon to continue to operate. And Dennis, God forbid, an earthquake like the one that just hit Russia hits here, because we are all dead meat.
Does big money and campaign contributions have anything to do with the resistance of politicians like the ones you're talking about to go solar. If it is, as you say, and I don't doubt it, you've been on this a long time, Harald, been studying this from top to bottom through the context of your group, Solartopia. What's the problem?
The problem is exactly as you say. It's money and politics. It's why we have Donald Trump in the White House. It's why we have a totally reactionary Congress and Supreme Court. It's all about the money. In this case, what we have worldwide is we have fossil fuel and nuclear power interests that have enormous investments that they want to cash out. Everybody who knows anything about energy knows that the world is going full bore towards renewables. But these guys have inventory. You know, they call it stranded assets. They have coal, they got oil, they got gas, they got nuclear that they want to cash out before we go 100% renewable. And that's the case in California as well. The, you know, nuclear power is just a stalking horse to divert people's attention from the realities of how cheap and reliable and job-producing renewables have become. Even as an advocate since the 1970s, I wouldn't have predicted, nobody would have predicted how rapidly wind and solar have come on technologically, just the drop in price. It's amazing. And so now you have places, you know, Trump ranting and raved about how much he hates wind power, right in the middle of him cheating on his golf score. And he said that he told the world that wind is the most expensive electricity there is. In fact, it's the cheapest. Nuclear is the most expensive by far. Wind power is the cheapest. And it's the cleanest, safest, along with solar. There's been a revolution in the technology. We in California have the highest electric rates in the continental United States for one reason, Diablo Canyon. Newsom is bailing out Diablo Canyon for $11 billion over market. At the same time, he's assaulting solar. There is absolutely no reason technologically or economically why California should not be 100% renewable right now. And Newsom is the reason. And as a result, we're taking this horrible gamble with these uninsured, uninspected atomic reactors at Diablo Canyon. It's a nightmare.
Uninsured means a limited liability that the Price-Anderson Act gives it. And I'm going to excerpt that. That's from Friday's Flashpoint Swift KPFA archives, if you want to hear the rest of... I guess I didn't foreshadow the fact that he was going to be talking about the posturing, the nuclear posturing that's going on in the midday of Trump fracas. It'd be laughable if it wasn't so bloody dangerous. I've been trying to figure out how to excerpt the Vicky Ward interview. I guess I'm just going to do it crudely when the time looks like it's right. And yeah, so about 15 minutes of this half-hour segment. And then a part of the Frontline program, I guess he's trying to launch a new regular feature with Sam Husseini, who I praised so much. And he's definitely a go-to guy up there with Phyllis Bennis and Peter Beinart and Joel Beinan. And I have to get to the air when they when they have a Pacifica product. You can look through AudioPort and see what Pacifica does. You can look through, yeah, anyway. There's a lot out there. It makes it daunting to figure out what to highlight. I'll mention the Solidarity event again, Summer of Solidarity, the fifth and final panel. Quite a extensive panel. 1 to 3 this afternoon at the Channing Murray Foundation. Sort of on the periphery of campus, but campus is pretty empty right now, so easy parking, etc. Here's that part of the web exclusive with the woman that broke the Epstein story. There's a lot in here, and I commend your attention. You can go to the Democracy Now! Site if you want to hear the whole 2 hours. I didn't talk much about Epstein. I did mention the Chomsky connection. Apparently he did some financial transactions for Chomsky, but it was in the aftermath of them talking. He wanted to use Epstein's connections to get in touch with some what were then called labor politicians in Israel. Well-connected all around. There's a mention of Gaddafi, and I remember now Gaddafi's son was like a bon vivant all over Europe in the casinos, so I guess that's where Epstein and Gaddafi's son met.
At Trump's attempt to quell his MAGA base uproar over the Trump administration's refusal to release the files of dead serial sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein. President Donald Trump's deputy attorney general, who is Trump's former private lawyer, just finished 2 days of meetings with the convicted felon Ghislaine Maxwell, who's serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse young girls. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche and Maxwell met for 9 hours at the courthouse in Tallahassee, Florida. Now, I want to go back to April, when Virginia Roberts Giuffre, an outspoken survivor of sex trafficking by Jeffrey Epstein, died apparently by suicide in Australia at the age of 41. She was the first survivor to come out publicly against Jeffrey Epstein, as well as Ghislaine Maxwell. Virginia also sued Prince Andrew for sexually assaulting her when she was 17. The disgraced prince was forced to step away from his royal duties and settled with Giuffre in 2022. In a statement, Giuffre's family said, quote, Virginia was a fierce warrior in the fight against sexual abuse and sex trafficking. She was the light that lifted so many survivors, unquote. Back in 2019, Virginia Giuffre spoke to the BBC.
It was a wicked time in my life. It was a really scary time in my life. I had just been abused by a member of a royal family. So when you talk about these chains, you know, yeah, I wasn't chained to a sink, but these powerful people were my chains. I didn't know what could happen. And I couldn't comprehend how in the highest levels of the government and powerful people were allowing this to happen, not only allowing it to happen, but participating in it.
But by participating in it as well. That was Virginia Roberts Giuffre in 2019. We're now continuing our conversation with Vicky Ward, the longtime investigative journalist who wrote for Vanity Fair, now host and co-producer of the podcast series and TV series Chasing Ghislaine, the untold story of the woman in Epstein's shadow. If you can give us some background on Giuffre. This was back in 2019. That's when Jeffrey Epstein was charged in a much more comprehensive and serious way, to be followed a few years later by Ghislaine Maxwell after he supposedly committed suicide. And she was found guilty. Give us the history of this story and what Virginia is alleging.
Well, so Virginia Roberts Giuffre plays a really, really important role in all of it, because So after Jeffrey Epstein avoids federal charges the first time round, when the feds come for him in 2000, investigate him in 2006 for the next couple of years, that is when there is this sweetheart. He has a huge team of hugely influential and high-powered lawyers, and he is able, we don't yet know all the details as to quite why, but he is able to,
and these lawyers, just to say, Acosta, from Ken Starr to Alan Dershowitz, a battery of lawyers.
Right. There were 9 of them, I believe. And they managed to convince Alex Acosta, then Attorney General in Florida, to drop the federal... Sorry, yes, to then drop the federal charges. And instead, he gets this slap on the wrist. He pleads guilty to the state charges, which is one count of prostitution and one count of soliciting a minor. And as you outlined, Amy, he has this really cushy 13-month sentence where he's, you know, half in the jail, half not. He goes to work, you know, and he comes out basically unscathed and carries on. Virginia surfaced, but what had happened that was illegal was that this plea deal had been done without notifying any of the women, any of the victims who had come forward. Virginia, who was not part of that case, joined what was a class action lawsuit of all the victims coming together. And because she had a rather infamous photograph of herself with Ghislaine Maxwell and Prince Andrew, with his arm around her waist, her allegations immediately hit the headlines. And she went public accusing, as you said, not just Jeffrey Epstein, but also Prince Andrew. And also she named other men who she claimed Jeffrey Epstein had pimped her out to. Ghislaine Maxwell, and Virginia Roberts did all this publicly. And the Ghislaine Maxwell then in public called her a liar, at which point Virginia Roberts sued Ghislaine Maxwell civilly. And ultimately, although this case was settled, it was all the depositions and the discovery in that civil litigation that really then became the backbone of the government's charges that they finally brought against Jeffrey Epstein in 2019. As you say, he then dies in strange circumstances without facing the music. But the stuff that was in the civil litigation with Virginia Roberts is also what formed the backbone of the government's case against Ghislaine Maxwell during her trial. Virginia Roberts was not called as a witness in her trial. And that, you know, largely was to do with the fact that when there has been a big civil case, prosecutors prefer not to go down that discovery. And they found four other victims to actually appear in court to testify against Ghislaine Maxwell. But a lot of what Virginia Roberts had said about Ghislaine Maxwell came up in that courtroom.
Now, one of the things you point out in your series is this deal that the U.S. attorney at the time, then chosen as labor secretary by Trump in his first term, then forced to resign immediately because all of the scandal came up as a result of Julie Brown's reporting in the Miami Herald. Like, why did he make this sweetheart deal? In the actual deal, it says, in consideration of Epstein's agreement to plead guilty and to provide compensation in the manner described above, if Epstein successfully fulfills all the terms and conditions of this agreement, the United States also agrees it will not institute any criminal charges against any potential co-conspirators of Epstein, including but not limited to, and the names are blocked out, but something like four names. Now, this could be the basis, right, of Ghislaine Maxwell getting off. It says not only if he does this 13-month sweetheart deal, but anyone who is involved with sexually abusing or raping girls or women will be protected from prosecution. Is this possible?
Yes. I mean, the whole non-prosecution agreement was something that, you know, his attorneys believed would have actually protected him, too. I mean, his own attorney, Jeffrey Epstein's attorney, Reid Weingarten, told me that one of the reasons he found it very difficult to believe initially that Jeffrey Epstein had committed suicide was that they'd had a whole conversation the day before in which his attorney said, you know, I don't think the government will be able to keep going with the charges against you because of this non-prosecution agreement. Muddying the waters, Amy, I will tell you, you know, the four names that are redacted in the non-prosecution agreement. I mean, I know who they are. And again, it speaks to, the sickness of this web. You know, these are all women who were victims at one point of Jeffrey Epstein, who they're victims who then turned around and brought in, helped bring in other women. But yeah, unquestionably, Ghislaine Maxwell believed she was and still believes she is protected by the non-prosecution agreement. 100%.
And then Alex Acosta said something very unusual when he was really pressed about why he would do this, when, in fact, the investigations that were going on in Florida brought up dozens and dozens of women who, in many cases, were girls when Epstein raped or assaulted them, in some cases with the help of Ghislaine Maxwell. He mentioned something about, I thought he was involved with intelligence.
Well, so that is my reporting, and I 100% stand by it. He said that when the issue of Jeffrey Epstein came up during the transition, and he was asked, you know, by the committee during the Trump transition, you know, they get a sheet of background because he's going to have to be confirmed by the Senate. And it's like, oh, yeah, you were the guy who gave Jeffrey Epstein his plea, you know, his plea deal. Is there any problem with that? And that is when he said, you know, it was a very quick conversation. No, I was told he belonged to intelligence. And this, you know, this comes back to, I think, Amy, the heart of the questions swirling around Jeffrey Epstein and why it is that the MAGA base want answers, because people want to understand the network of men who enabled Jeffrey Epstein, the system of soft power around him that enabled him to wield so much influence in the face of such horrendous criminal charges. So, you know, why did so many prominent men gather around Epstein, many of them, you know, finance him? I mean, there's no evidence that Jeffrey Epstein abused or trafficked underage women until he quite mysteriously, this is a man who's not a college graduate, he was a high school math teacher, he suddenly, in the 1990s, explodes with all this money. You know, vast wealth, and builds that, you know, he's in this enormous private townhouse in Manhattan. He's got an island, and it's almost like the walls go up behind which he starts to do these, perform these terrible sex crimes. But why and how did he make all this money? Why and how were all these bold-faced names frequently in his company, on his planes, going to his island with him? You know, why did he carry on almost in plain sight with impunity? And that's the question that people want answered.
And who were some of...
If you want to hear some more names, you can go to the web-exclusive section of Democracy Now! Now hear Sam Husseini on some other aspects of the Epstein business that I had never heard before. Something about some banks that he was involved with, notably. This is an excerpt from, I guess, a rollout of a new regular segment with Sam Husseini called Frontline. I guess they're going to inherit the name from the PBS late, great, not so great PBS show.
In that context, and then there has been over the last several weeks a great deal of discussion about the Jeffrey Epstein files. And you have a great deal of the so-called MAGA base upset at Trump and various other people in the Trump administration who had been going to town, Kash Patel, his FBI director, and others, talking about how they're going to release the Epstein files and, you know, expose the deep state and all of this kind of stuff. And they all did a 180 and are saying there's nothing to see here. And a good deal of the MAGA base is at some level correctly calling them out on it, although very few members of Congress are breaking from Trump over this. But there's virtually no discussion of the deeper issues around the Jeffrey Epstein case. And there are two aspects that are critical to understand about Jeffrey Epstein. One is that he has multiple ties to Israel. And two is that there's substantial evidence that he was involved in not just pedophilia, but in blackmail. That is, the point of much of his enterprise seems not to have been simply abuse underage females, but to get footage of prominent, powerful people doing that in order to use that as blackmail over them. There's substantial evidence, and has been for some time, to that effect, but there's very little discussion about that in the mainstream discussion. And certainly, the parties have now flipped position on this, right? Like a year ago, it was Republicans saying, release the Epstein file, release the Epstein file, release the Epstein files. And of course, Biden wasn't going to do that. Additional footnote, the judge who it was recently reported that the judge who sealed much of the Epstein files, her husband is a major partner at a law firm that is connected to virtually every bank that Jeffrey Epstein was associated with in his financial dealings. Bear Stearns, where he got his start, and J.P. Morgan, that last year had to do a huge payout over his scandals, and that she got a sweetheart deal on a penthouse in dealing with one of the bigwigs at Bear Stearns. So that's another aspect of this cover-up. But the two parties are playing this, what seems like an oppositional role, but is actually a symbiotic role. That is, the Republicans had been saying, release the Epstein files, and the Democrats weren't doing so, Biden and company. And now with Trump in office, it's the Democrats screaming, release the Epstein files, and Trump not doing so. Now, Trump is paying something of a political price for that, because a bunch of his mega base is upset over this, and Tucker Carlson and Josh Rogan and whoever else are upset about this. But what are they going to do, vote Democrat? No. That's how the system works. Politicians break their promises, and Trump is obviously happy to break this promise. And there are other aspects to this. For example, the Democrats, when they talk about release the Epstein files, you've had several of them, most prominently Hakeem Jeffries, one of the main Democratic leaders in Congress, say, why is Trump covering up? You know, Trump is clearly covering up for his billionaire cronies, but he doesn't name them. And we can name them. We don't have to wait for the Epstein files to be released. It's been clear for several years who among some of these billionaires are. Les Wexner is clearly at the top of the list. He was CEO for Victoria's Secrets. Victoria's Secret is a billionaire. He owns a huge chunk of Columbus, Ohio. He gave Epstein his residence in Manhattan, reportedly the largest private residence in Manhattan, a huge townhouse that was reportedly wired to the max, that it had like a room with, you know, surveillance cameras throughout the house, ideal for setting up a blackmail ring, that is to capture people in illicit positions, illicit situations that you can then use to blackmail them. There's no reason why, there's no good reason why someone like Hakeem Jeffries should be going on about how Trump is colluding with his billionaire buddies over Epstein to not name who they are. And Les Wexner is a very, very prominent supporter of Israel. He founded what was called the Mega Group with the Bronfmans of the Seagram's liquor empire. And has raised billions for all and many things Israel related, from AIPAC to a whole, you know, list of other things. He's also, I mean, there are all kinds of familial ties as well. His brother, his father-in-law is Yehud Koppel, who's an Israeli military veteran with ties to Israeli intelligence. He's credited with helping found Israel through his role of the atrocity checkered Haganah militia.
This is Les Wexner, right? We're talking about Les Wexner now, the founder of L Brands and all kinds of other stuff. Yes, go on.
Right.
Well, oh, we should mention Hakeem Jeffries. Does Hakeem Jeffries receive a lot of money from Israeli lobbyists?
I don't have that at my fingertips. That would certainly be my my presumption. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit more about what's going on here.
Yeah, so you have Epstein, who has multiple ties to Israel, and this whole, everybody's talking about Epstein and somehow managing to not talk about Israel. Another major aspect to this is the Maxwells. Now, his partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has been in prison for the last several years following his alleged suicide. Epstein's brother hired a pathologist who says that it wasn't a suicide, who says that he was killed while in federal custody in New York. And there are a whole series of scandals over that. The videotape, you know, allegedly malfunctioned, so they don't have actual footage of what happened. He was given all kinds of items which would assist in a suicide or murder, and so on. But Ghislaine Maxwell, her father is Robert Maxwell, who was outed as an Israeli super spy in 1991 by Seymour Hersh in his book, The Samson Option, about Israel's nuclear weapons capacity. He died mysteriously about a week after that book was released. So he's outed as an Israeli super spy, and he's killed on his, or he dies mysteriously on his yacht a week after that. I had my screen here. So, you know, what is the, and there are other connections there. For example, his lawyer and confidant, the last person to speak with him before his mysterious death, was Samuel Pizar. Samuel Pizar is Tony Blinken's stepfather. And Tony Blinken, the former Secretary of State during the Biden administration, who supported Israel's genocide to the hilt, invoked Samuel Pizar's name on many occasions in prominent speeches and so on. And furthermore, Samuel Dazar, I didn't find this out until quite recently, was also for a time counsel to Epstein himself directly. So there's a whole series of very bizarre, to put it politely, in addition to the obvious things. For example, you had Ehud Barak, former prime minister of Israel, visiting the Manhattan residence of Epstein on many, many occasions documented. You have Epstein visiting the Clinton White House. The two figures that that Epstein is closest to are Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. He was incredibly close with both of them. At one point, Epstein described Donald Trump as his best friend. You have him visiting Clinton in the White House, I believe, 17 times. And there's a context to this as well in terms of the aspects of sexual blackmail. You know, the nexus between the U.S. and Israeli establishment, I think, has many nefarious aspects to it that effectively compel U.S. politicians to act in certain ways. One obvious thing is, as you allude to with Hakeem Jeffries, is the money, that a lot of U.S. politicians get a lot of money from AIPAC and other groups. Another is simple fear of the money. So, for example, in the last election cycle, you had at least two critics of Israel be knocked out because of massive AIPAC money, Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush. And there's a history of this, of many other prominent Congress people who speak up against Israel, and then there's a flood of money. It happened in my district with Donna Edwards. She was, I believe, the only member of Congress to ever go to Hamas and in the last election, where she tried to run. Various groups flooded, and they wouldn't talk about Israel on the ads, mind you. They would just talk about how she's bad at constituent services, and they'd flood the airwaves with tons of ads talking about how bad she is at constituent services, and so she loses. So the money is one aspect of control, but there is substantial evidence that there could be other methods of control, and there's a who's who, from Bill Richardson to George Mitchell to all of these people who were on Epstein's flights to on his Lolita Express. That's what he named his airplane, to his island. So there's substantial indications that that is part of what's going on here. And the mainstream media, yeah, go ahead.
Go on, please. Sorry.
So, you know, the focus is continuously on, Trump is defending, this pedophile and da-da-da-da-da-da, and Trump calls him, a creep and all of this. But there's virtually no or minimal examination, certainly not in Congress and not much in the mainstream media, some on Twitter and such, examining the Israel connections and the blackmail aspects. And there are other precursors to this that people should bear in mind. For example, there were serious allegations that Israel knew about the Lewinsky scandal with Clinton and tried to use that as leverage against him. Specifically, the Times of Israel ran things about Israel trying to get Pollard, their spy, who was imprisoned in the U.S. for many years, pardoned and released, which he eventually was. Trump eventually let him go, and Sheldon Adelson, or I don't know who was before or after Sheldon Adelson died, the Adelson's plane actually took him to Israel, where he is now a very militaristic, fanatic figure. So there's evidence that there have been other instances when Israel used this as an additional measure of leverage over U.S. political figures.
We're speaking with Sam Husseini. He's our special correspondent in Washington, D.C. And to sort of help bring it all together, the bottom line here is the U.S. Congress is owned by Israel and Israeli lobbyists. And so we're talking about a situation where I guess we can call this a bipartisan problem. I guess we can't say this is not simply a Republican thing, right, at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what a lot of folks on the left need to understand at this point, because the Democrats are attempting to brand themselves as, for you know, getting all the Epstein files out there. I think that they're only doing that at this juncture because they know that Trump won't release them. And so he just left holding the bag politically, but that doesn't mean that they actually want them released. I think that a lot of Democrats or Democratic operatives, and certainly Bill Clinton and many others, will be very vulnerable.
Yes, that's from Frontline. I think I'm playing all of that because there was a long segment about the horrible situation in Israel. Opinions are those of the speakers. That was, again, Sam Husseini on Frontlines. It was from the yesterday's segment. Thanks for listening. I'm out of here. Here's another underwriting announcement, and Radio Free Labor is about to hit the airwaves.
Brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and by Urbana Acupuncture. Urbana Acupuncture offers safe, gentle,